terms of the possibilities of cooperation and the lack of distrust of the people involved, you know, now you could pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm a member of the same club, we're trying to do the same thing, will you help me? Which is how I put the Turkoman exhibition together. I had such incredible help. I mean, how I did it was, I remember, I was at Nosha, and Reza Wahbi was there, and cornered him. I said, Reza, you want to help me? Which he always wanted to. He was an amazing, amazingly positive man. All the people I was working for at this period were very positive, even though the revolution was around the corner. It was very strange. I mean, it's a year before the revolution. Please help me. I want to do a Turkoman exhibition. I need contacts. I need, he said, fine, put together a board for me of everyone at television who had anything to do with Turkoman. I had such access, it was unbelievable. He got me a specialist who was a Turkoman himself, who arranged an entire trip for me through Turkoman Saray to get all the contacts, to see all the local dances and the folklore and the music. I mean, everything. We were going to do a major festival in Iran. And it was thanks to being able to corner somebody like Reza Wahbi and say, I want your help. And he would say, you know, I want to help you. I mean, this was happening too. You know, it was happening. So it was, you know, there were endless possibilities once you became part of this. Endless possibilities. Working, you know, with Tomoka or with anything, with the Shiraz Arts Festival, it was really through the Queen's influence, I think. All of these organizations were now had a feeling of community, mm-hmm. sense of community, and we were going to get the money to go with it.
What was your budget?
You know, I don't remember. Some reason I think it was somewhere between $300,000 and $500,000.
A year.
Yeah. Something like that. A couple of million tomas. Or maybe it was even, you know, I really cannot remember. It was very small. Maybe it was 8 million tomas. I mean, I really, mm-hmm. really cannot remember. it was very small compared to Tomoka. They had a huge budget. Most of it for acquisitions, but they also had a huge staff. And that was another thing, the fact that Tomoka existed and that it was made on a really international level was due to Kwame Dubois and his experience as an architect and his contacts in the West. He came into his job much more experienced than I did and more powerful than I did. So from the time that the Tomoka existed, Carpet Museum, no, because Nazi didn't have that kind of influence and push. I don't mean personal influence, I mean simply didn't have the kind of training and background that Kwame already did. Or
What was Kwame's training?
Well, he was an American-trained architect and painter who had been working at his trade for at least 10, 15 years. And he was very influential. He had his own office, you know, architectural office, and he had done major commissions in Iran, designed buildings. I mean, he was already quite an important figure when he was put in charge of Tomoka.
And he designed
the museum itself, which I think was a very original design, a very good design that actually worked for the people who lived in it. I mean, you know, it was conceived as a museum, and so it didn't have any of the problems that we had.
Wasn't it very similar to another Spanish museum?
It was, and I can't remember.
Cervantes, was that his name?
What is very strange is that I was in Spain last year, and I saw this building, and I went, oh my God, it's so similar. And I can't remember where I saw it. But it did have, it had these sort of round, what were they? I don't know how to describe
cylinder type
elements in the roof, which gave it a very, very distinctive silhouette. But it was an element that was adapted or had been inspired by another piece of architecture somewhere, which I don't think really detracts from it at all. I think there are very few buildings in the world that haven't taken elements from somewhere else. But it was a building that worked. And also it had, as I said, it was a major project compared to Nigaristan, which sort of was a little baby that grew with time. But because there was this going on, I could ask for more things for the museum. I mean, this obviously was sort of Peter principle or whatever, you know, that, well, if Tomoka has this, you know, we should be able to have it. If they can have these salaries, they had to allow us to raise our salaries. Once we were part of Bonyard particularly was a godsend because their the salaries of television were going to be the salaries we applied to our scale. And I was very, very happy for my workers because I knew, thank God, that they would get decent salaries. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is very, very important for the museum, for what we were going to be able to do and accomplish. Now, as I said, my initial contacts were directly with Reza Porfi and Holly Espander, who was his assistant. And then about 6 months or a year into the Bonyard, there were a lot of changes, as you remember, in the last year in Iran, you know, on the governmental level. A lot of ministers were removed. Holdeja was particularly switched from prime minister to minister of court, and in the process also Majidi was resigned or was out. And so what happened was that the Bonyard, which originally was directly under Reza Bodvi's influence, and you almost felt it was very small, you knew it was going to get a lot bigger, but they worked out of what was that? There was this wonderful building that they had completely remodeled. Oh, I can't remember it, on the old Shimron Road. Maybe the name will come back to me. It was an incredible Qajar building that belonged to famous Qajar general, prince in general. Cannot remember his name. And it had amazing Gashkari carved plaster work. And all of this had been remodeled and redone to serve as the center for the Bonyard. And this is where it first worked out of. And that's also where they had the African exhibition, which was kind of the kickoff for the Bonyard. In any case, the Bonyard originally was supposed to be run by Reza Bodvi. And then, I think when the political scene shifted, Mr. Majidi was put in charge. So, at the very beginning, I worked with Reza and Hore, and then with Majidi. There was a great deal of autonomy. I don't recall ever being given directives. I recall that you were working within a framework which you agreed with totally. From the beginning, you know, you had been mapped out that you were going to have a permanent collection, you were going to have cultural activities, you were going to have acquisitions. And as time went on, all these things did fall into place. Your only limit was how much money you had to accomplish these things. And none of this changed when you became part of the Bonyard, but it was just everything became much, much better. And you had a lot more people to turn to. From that point on, the budget was going to be part of the national budget. I was going to, you know, I mean, I actually had a possibility of planning, you know, saying I need this and I need that, and I have these many workers and I'll need this many next year, and their salaries have to be this, and I'm going to do 3 exhibitions. You know, I mean, it was finally getting on a professional level, really. So, all, you know, this was very important in terms of what could be done. And then my sort of financial contacts were no longer with the Dakhtar muscles, but with television, and because they were supplying the financial administration of the Bonyard. And as the Bonyard developed, people were being taken from TV, particularly the Hisandar of TV. His name I forget, but was a very, very competent man, very understanding man. My God, after years of working with the Dakhtar Mahsous, where everything was nickel and dime, it was run very much on that kind of a basis, you know, very low salaries, everything hush-hush. You know, it was very difficult to work in that atmosphere. The Bonyard was something totally different. You had people who understood about money and salaries and how people had to live and what you needed to spend. So it was very, very refreshing to finally be in this kind of atmosphere. Anyway, so I worked with the Hesabdar. And this is where things stood when the revolution happened. Now, the last thing that I would say is that I finally had my own budget. I had my own board of directors, and we met maybe 2 or 3 times before the revolution came. And I particularly proposed one thing I wanted, which was an English watercolor that was in a sale in London. That was a copy of the original paintings that fill the three walls of the original Nagarstan Museum, which the museum was named after. Mm-hmm. It was a palace of the period of Fatehshah. So I fought very hard and long to get this and convince people that I wanted it. But we also got some gifts, which I no longer remember. They were not very important. But the last thing that was very important was there was a sale in London in October, 78. And there was a painting by Abdullah Khan, who was the original painter of the Nagarstan murals, which were gone. It was a painting of Abbas Mirza, Prince Abbas Mirza, who was Fatehli Shah's son and heir. And it was a major, absolutely guaranteed provenance example of Qajar painting. I wanted it for the museum. I got the approval of everyone concerned and went to London. I had a gentleman bidding on this for me, who was an Iranian living in London, who was a former minister of arts and culture in Iran.
Who's that?
And I cannot remember his name. It might come back to me eventually. So I did this in secrecy. I didn't want anyone to know that I was bidding on this painting. And so he bid on it for me. He got it. And one of the great tragedies of the revolution was that this was in October 78. I went back to Iran and saw the situation was very bad, particularly because the Gumruk was closed. Nothing could come into the country. And I contacted a few people that I knew and asked them, could they be of any help to me that I bought this painting in London? Could I get it to Iran? And it was a moment in which everything was getting to a standstill. I mean, literally, I think I even went and asked the Queen, and it was just not going to be possible. So the painting was in London. And I told the man not to send it until I knew how we were going to get it out of Bogota. And he was, for reasons of his own, I don't know what they were, decided to send it. And sure enough, it fell right into the revolution and has disappeared.
You know it's disappeared.
I know it would never.
Leila, let's talk a little bit now about the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. How did it get started? Who was running it? Come in your own words.
I think that the idea of a museum of modern art was a dream, part of a dream that went back many years to the Queen. And, you know, from the time I think that she was first an architecture student and then she came back to Iran and was collecting herself and was involved, and it was certainly part of her image to eventually make a museum like this. Don't forget, it would not have been the first museum of modern art as such to exist. India had a museum of modern art and modern architecture. It hadn't had, I think, a museum of modern art, but there were museums in which there was modern art, even though I think it was modern Indian art. So in one sense, it was not going to be without precedence, and in another sense, it was going to be unique. But I think Iran was in a very unique sociological and financial position, and we were trying to get into the 21st century in a minimal amount of time, and at the time, it seemed something we needed to complete our education, our artistic education. Anyway, we had, I think the main idea of having a museum of modern art was that we had many artists, we wanted them to prosper, we wanted them to have available a source of the visual images that would help them to formulate a higher quality of art than what they had been doing, so they didn't have to go to Europe to get an education. And of course, whoever went to Europe only got the education of that country, the visual education. We had artists who were mainly formed in France or in Italy, and most of them represented this kind of old-fashioned approach that was current, say, in the 50s or 60s, a pictographic or ideographic kind of approach. And they went to Europe and sort of, either that or they came back as almost academics. You know, they didn't come back as surrealist painters or as, you know, as really having been able to steep themselves in the current contemporary artistic language, which is what you need to form a really superior, if you like, modern artist. So I think these are some of the ideas that were in back of why, you know, one would want a museum of modern art. And then because obviously, there were always problems in planning in Iran, and then there were always problems in people's different priorities. Partly, as I mentioned, there had been plans for the creation of the Museum of Modern Art in Shiraz, and all the maquette and the whole system had been planned by Alvar Aalto, and they had all of this that had already been commissioned. and the person who was particularly pushing this was Manager Ivan Pur. So that for some reason, the Museum of Modern Art became a museum of contemporary art. What all the reasonings behind this were, I don't know. But one of the givens was perhaps the idea that eventually the collections might be divided into contemporary and modern. But that, well, as long as we had a museum, let's put everything there. And of course, in Iran also, I think the quality of a project depended on the person who became immediately involved with it. I don't know if Kamran Zibar had been slated as the director of this museum from day one. I never got that impression. But then, of course, I was never told that I was director of the museum until the day, literally, the museum opened and I was said, congratulations, this is now your job. I mean, this was the way things were done in Iran. You were not given tremendous advance notice about who was going to be running any given institution. So it was a project that was conceived in the Daftar Mahsus by non-specialists, if you like, with various inputs from many different people. But when it came down, in terms of the collection, it was what the queen had been buying, Takutut, from various sources for at least, I would say, about 2 years. A lot from the Galerie Mag, from various private sources, from particularly this Mr. Vakil in the Vatican, who was an art expert. So I never met him, but he was sort of the contact, and then Donna Stein as the contact. So part of a collection was already built up. The modern Iranian works of art that were part of the selection, I don't know who was responsible for their choosing. I also forgot to mention that Ferishted Afteri was very much involved with all of this until about a year before the museum opened, at which point she left the Daftar Mahsus and she went to work for Behnam at one of the universities. I forget which university it was. Anyway, so she left the project, as I said, about a year before the museum opened.
Why did she leave the project?
I think it was for personal reasons. I never understood. She had the chance to be curator, but I think she just wasn't ready for perhaps the infighting or, you know, the realities of what it meant to run an institution or to have to fight for the job. Because it was basically a position many people wanted or would have wanted or felt qualified for. And she could have had it, but she didn't want it. She left and she went to teach. And this was her choice. Nobody, you know, I mean, she could have had it. But about at the same time she was leaving, that was when Kamran, I think, was actually put in charge of opening the museum. I don't think he was called director from day one. He was, you know, this is the way things were done. You know, you were not given a position from day one. You were put in charge of, you were manager, you were whatnot, you could farm out the work. And that was how the museum opened, basically. Kamran put together a staff of foreign experts, mainly. He did have, he had a few Iranians. I'm talking about the absolute top level of the management. Galloway, Robert Hobbs, Donna Stein. I think he had input also from other sources. Kami himself had a lot of connections with, say, German collectors. I particularly remember someone called Ludwig, who had huge collections, mainly of contemporary art. And there was some relations there. And also Kami bought art directly himself from New York for the collection via Tony Shafrazi, mainly, was the agent in between. So the collection was a very varied, you know, many people put different levels of input into it. The actual installation and catalog and opening was, I think, mainly collaboration of Kamran and of Galloway. And Galloway, and, oh, I forgot, Nasrin Fahy. Now, they had a department there. I don't know if it was architectural drawings or something, because her field was architecture. And I specifically, I mean, there were a lot of shows they put on at the Modern, At the Museum of Contemporary Art, besides the opening, obviously. But I particularly remember she did a show of Reza Shah period architecture of drawings, which was fascinating because it was, you know, this sort of 1930s, 1940s kind of Mussolini-type architecture, which was current in Hungary and in Iran. And it was fascinating to see drawings of buildings that either didn't exist or might not exist in 10, 15 years. So she was active there for a while. But she was a very difficult personality and eventually talked to her or sort of intrigued herself out of the job because she was a very, very intriguing kind of person. Anyway, so I don't remember exactly what year Tomoka opened. Was it open for more than, I mean, it was
Not more than 3 years.
Oh, much less. It was either two years or a year and a half, approximately, because it was the last museum to open. Mm-hmm. And it opened, I always sort of date things by the Festival of Islam. That was 76. And, you know, that was summer of 76. And then by December 78, that was the revolution. So maximum 2 years, probably more a year and a half. I don't remember exactly. I mean, if I really try, I suppose I could remember exactly when it was. But in any case, so I think it definitely opened with Kamran as director. And these certain people there, but within a year and a half, Galloway, Hobbes, Stein, all these people had left. And
but they, for what reasons?
I don't know. There were obviously conflicts. I think it was very difficult for foreigners to work in Iran. They always met a lot of pressure and a lot of difficulty of trying to work with an Iranian staff. Also, the museum opened with a big bang and a huge budget. And I think that then, that by the next year, there were a lot of financial problems already. By the second year, they just couldn't keep up that standard. You know, I remember when the first, at the beginning when you walked in, I mean, first of all, it was absolutely beautifully designed. I mean, it was one of the most impressive things I'd seen in Iran, as I knew museums. It, as I explained earlier, Tomoka was unique because it was one whole concept. It was one project where one man was able to fulfill, in a sense, his vision from beginning to end with the minimum amount of compromises, which is not true for all the other museums. You know, there were always 50 hands in the pie. Here, it was Kamran's concept of the museum, and even though the collections were not completely formed by him, as I said, there were quite a few things that had been bought that came from various sources. There were probably donations. I don't remember who chose the Iranian works of art that were going to be there. If it was Kamran himself, I don't remember, because I was already at the Nigar Stan by then, and it just, I don't remember how they bought from Iran.
I think Kamran was responsible for that, and one wonders to what extent he was qualified.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of emphasis put on the buying of foreign art, and for the Iranian artist, he didn't feel like he needed any help, whereas for the foreign art, you know, he had 10 different consultants,
yeah,
which was a big mistake.
Well, see, I don't know. That, as I said, I do not know who bought the Iranian art. Well, with the Iranian art, part of it, of course, he was an artist himself. So he knew the other artists, but that also meant that he would have his favorites. It also meant that he would have to have a certain bias in which art he thought was, I mean, it was inevitable that he would have a certain bias in terms of which art he thought was museum worthy. Okay? Because, I mean, I myself know that coming from a relatively contemporary Western formation to Kamran's, when I came to Iran, there were certain artistic styles that for me were definitely yesterday. And they were yesterday, I mean, something like Bahman Moises, definitely yesterday. You know, I don't know if I got the first name right. But, so in any case, you know, it would be bound to be a little bit one-sided. So you have a sort of lopsided collection coming into being a little bit. Also a collection in which there was a lot more immediate money spent than in any one previously. The Nigaristan, as I showed you, was sort of accumulation more than big amounts of money being spent, whereas I remember that Tomoka had a huge budget for opening, and once we were part of Bonyad, it had the heaviest budget of all the museums. But it was a place that was run the most professionally, had the largest staff, at the beginning anyway. It seemed, you know, really as if it was really a very major, major event for all of us. But it ran into trouble very early on. Conflicts of ego, I think a lot, conflicts, and then the possibility for intrigue. As I said, someone like Nasreen Pahi was a very talented woman, I thought. She was a very talented artist, but got involved in intrigues unbelievable in the museum. I personally remember something happening that I can't remember anymore, that I somehow got involved and I was terribly shocked. I mean, it was really intrigue. So these things happened, it sort of fell apart very quickly. What all the causes were, I don't know. We did talk about various artists feeling that they weren't properly representative or that they weren't properly supported. Maybe this would have straightened out eventually, because I feel that the museum had, in theory, had a very good board. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking we all had a good board for what we were lacking. I mean, I, as a young Western trained woman, had a board of elderly statesmen of Qajar art, if you like, who were extremely helpful to me. Now, that was my attitude also. I had a pretty ego-effacing attitude, whereas Kamran was a man who had already accomplished a great deal in his life. He thought of himself, and rightly so, I think, as one of Iran's major architects. He also had made quite a few enemies along the line. So he was walking into the job with a lot of problems already. And I knew quite a few of the people on his board. It was an interesting board because he had people like the Lodge of Ideas. He had Mehdi Kosar, he had Guguri Farmakonian. I remember his board better than mine. who else did he have? He had a very talented filmmaker on his board, whose name I forgot.
Golestan?
No, it wasn't Golestan, it was another one. But anyway, he had, I think, a board that would have supplemented his problems. But very early on, they came into a terrible clash, such as I never had with mine. Over finances, over a million questions, mainly finances, but it was all the result of intrigue from the museum itself. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of problems very early on, which really was a terrible shame. Mm-hmm. You know, because everyone was very optimistic at the beginning, and really I felt at the time of the revolution, obviously Kamran Thibault had to resign, and he no longer had the Queen's support. He told me himself, you know, that he went to Europe and he found out, you know, there were all these problems going on in Iran, and he came back and he didn't really have any choice. You know, eventually there was just too much opposition from his board. I think one of the problems is that not having spoken to him myself, I wonder if he thought of this as his baby. You know, the building was his. So perhaps he felt more than anyone, and obviously he was also an architect. He was used to running his own office, having his own way. I came from a museum background. In other words, I'd worked in museums. I'd seen how they were run. I accepted the fact that a museum a Western style museum is like a corporation. You have a board of directors which you are responsible to. This is how I viewed my function. They were advising me, correct. But I was also accepting them. There has to be mutual consent on both sides for the thing to work, which I don't think happened in Tomoka. There were conflicts, there were clashes, there was too much money, there were too many personalities. I stayed away from contemporary art like a plague. From the day the Nigaristan opened, people came to me and wanted me to do exhibitions, and I just refused. I said, my period stops in 1925, and that's it. For this very reason, because in Iran, if you dealt with modern art, you had to deal with people. And the artists are extremely sensitive personalities. As I was saying, artists were very sensitive people in Iran. I have to say that overall, as I said, I considered myself a relatively aware, relatively educated, not quite well educated in terms of modern art. After all, I had quite a good background from some of the best schools in the States. In terms of quality, in terms of 20th century art, and when I came to Iran, I have to say I was very disappointed at the level of art in the country, as I think it would have happened going to any, if you like, provincial area, to Paris or New York. You have to realize 20th century art was made not in Rome, not in London, not certainly anywhere further than that, but in Paris and in Rome. So it was a difficult situation because Iranian artists were simply not of an international caliber. They were not even, when I came, I simply didn't find any level of quality. I mean, having come from a Western formation, one had certain standards, certain expectations in terms of an artist's development, in terms of formal values, in terms of what he could do. And frankly, most artists seem to me to be hacks. Now, there were very few people in whom I could see even a developing career. The only one that I personally felt had real quality as an artist and showed a sense of development, showed my perception of strong formal values, and yet having a language that came out of the country, was Zendivdi. And everyone associated with that Sacre-Honnay school at least had a sense of authenticity about it. I think it's one of the, in terms of the art world, it's very difficult for a 20th century, whether he's a Moroccan or a Venezuelan or an Iranian artist, trying to find a vocabulary that really has meaning and trying to develop quality. I mean, sometimes Juan Gris was not a Spanish artist. He was a French artist. He was born in Spain. Picasso, and one forgets he was Spanish. You know, he was essentially French. And this was a problem that we faced in Iran. The East versus West is basically this dichotomy, this impossibility. And so there was a combination of a pretty mediocre art scene. One wanted it to be better, one wanted to support it, one wanted to see, you know, whatever one could, but it didn't meet your expectations. And yet, in terms of expectations, the artists, many of them had really inflated egos. I mean, unbelievable egos for what they were. And part of the reason being is that these many of them had not traveled in the world. I mean, they didn't know what Picasso was. They didn't know what your standards were. And one tried to be nice or say, yes, it's fine. But I mean, simply, they would have inflated egos because they hadn't had a chance to compare themselves on an international level. To realize, which they are doing now in post-revolutionary New York, there are many Iranian artists who are now having to compare themselves to the top art, contemporary art in the world, and now having to face the fact that they can't sell a painting, that they don't have it, you know? Well, if they had been made to face that in Iran, maybe we would have had less problems, but as it was, no. You know, one couldn't, or we couldn't tell them, listen, you know, you really need to go back to school, or you know, it's just not enough. It wasn't enough. There were really very few artists that, I mean, if you wanted to use one standard, how many of these artists were represented in any museums or collections outside of Iran? Now, the problem is, how is an art going to get better if you don't support it? You have to start somewhere. And I think that was what we never had the time to do. You know, maybe it should have been started sooner. I mean, you know, this was 1975 when I went back. How could we have started it sooner? Did we have the money to start it sooner? You know? I mean, Iran was a developing country. Art was a luxury. Artists were a luxury. So by 1975, when you had, or 1974, huge amounts of petrodollars coming in, yes, then we could start thinking about forming these artists and so on. But by then, you know, it was too much too late, you know. I mean, it would have been nice if they could have been formed in a more sort of consecutive kind of way over the previous 20 years, but that wasn't the case. There were very one-note artists, very, very one-note artists. And as I said, with expectations, because we had a system that even though it was a monarchy, it was almost a socialist state. We had, you know, I remember there was a point where we were offering free milk and cookies to every child in the school system. Well, that broke us. We did it for a year, and then it had to be cut out of the budget, because, I mean, what developed country can afford to do that? You know, we had socialized medicine. We had all these sort of almost a welfare state, you know, within a monarchy. And so it developed this kind of attitude. And the other thing being that since there was very little artistic patronage, and there were a lot of artists and not that many collectors, everyone then turned to the queen. And since this was anyway a very patriarchal society, hierarchical society, everyone looked to her to patronage. So it was a kind of the no exit situation, you know. The expectations were there, the quality wasn't there. The money was there, but it was too late.
Were there any programs set up to encourage the artists? Was there anything at all?
I really don't think there was much, no. I mean, I recall artists getting, from the time I was there, I do recall artists stepped up a lot, though. Now that I think of it, when I was in the Daphne Masters, they used to get scholarships. They were sent to the Venice Biennale. Eventually, there were trainloads of them that were literally taken to Europe at the Queen's expense and taken to various shows, and their works were shown. All happened in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, whether this was, I don't know, you know, what the politics behind it are. Was she finally given a red light? Was she given a huge budget? Was her, you know, money increased so that she could do more of this? Or was it decided that it was a good moment in time now to support the artists, whereas it hadn't been before? Was she involved in other things before? Certainly what I can say is the Ministry of Arts and Culture did nothing for contemporary art and modern artists in Iraq before that. Ministry of Arts and Culture was really hack-bound. They supported very well, if I may say, the arts and crafts movement in Iran. They're excellent. From the time of Reza Shah, they built, you know, art high schools, Hunaristan-hai Ziba, where they formed artists in the traditional way. I knew people who had graduated from that, very good artists, within a very traditional vocabulary, the vocabulary of, say, Hatankari or Rogankari, you know, all these traditional Persian crafts. And from within that, also a sort of debased Safavid style of miniature painting by people like Kash John and Hossein Beitar. These are the kind of artists that were somewhat supported by the Ministry of Arts and Culture. But everybody else, forget it. There was no one for them to turn to. There was certainly no non-royal patronage. And now, as I said, I can only speak from what I remember seeing. It's possible that artists were supported in many ways before I went to Iran that I don't know about. I mean, I know certainly their art was bought, collections were bought from them. I mean, I can think of a few artists that were the Tana Valise, for instance, Monia Farman Farmian. These are two of the artists that I know, either works or collections or whatever were bought from them. That's one way of supporting the arts. Another way, the way of scholarships or sending them abroad or whatever, I know that there was a certain program with this, but I think it was almost a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. You know, the same sort of experience as I had was, you know, trying to get people for museum training, just trying to find staff to run the museums. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, I mean, this was one of the problems of Tomoka. Where do you find Iranians for the job? Wouldn't I be willing to put an Iranian in the job? Yes, but where do I find a qualified Iranian for a Western-style institution? This, again, was a problem. Museums were Western institutions, needing Western-trained staff. Okay? We had the buildings before we had the staff. We had the buildings before we had the collections. You're trying to put all these things together. It's hard. It's really hard. Especially, you know, there were accusations, there were problems. I remember people objected terribly to the patronage of Roloff Benny. Huh? Chocolate box art, I remember they called it. Well, was there an Iranian photographer who could do better? This is the question I have to ask. I don't know. I personally didn't know of any. Roloff Benny was a kind of slick, view of Iran, but he was an amazing photographer. I mean, technically, and in terms of his vision, he really produced. But I think people, I know, objected very strongly to the image, because he gave sort of pasteurized image of Iran in his books, you know, in his Persia Bridge of Turquoise. And I did an exhibition of his posters and of pictures drawn from that. Nobody came, you know. Now, maybe if I'd done the work of an Iranian photographer, they would have come, even if it was mediocre. And this again, you get down to it. Yes, there were Iranians who could have been used, but most of them were mediocre. Could they have done better? Yes, with support. Was the support there? Who was coming? You know, so that's, you know, the problem over and over again.
Okay, now that we've talked about all the reasons, maybe you'd like to sort of recap in the sense of describe how you feel this whole art scene fit in to the society and the political situation.
I think in a sense, well, you know, I should mention that there were a series of articles written after the revolution in Art in America, 3, about the whole museum and art scene in Iran. And in that article it was said, well, the building of museums was just part of Pahlavi's propaganda efforts. And there was no point for museums at all except to impress foreign visitors and foreign press, and nobody was interested in local consumption. That's ridiculous. Our leaders and our elite were concerned with the West, but sometimes we even unnecessarily felt very superior to the West. But to say, I mean, that this was the end-all and be-all of the program is ridiculous. Museums were part of a larger scene. They were part of the sense of using Iranian culture as a means of binding the country together. It was part of a sense of patriotism, a sense of nationalism that I think was the Pahlavis were trying to foster, and a sense of unity. Didn't have anything to do with Islam. As a matter of fact, I think it was almost contrary. It was part of an overall program of trying to educate and modernize this country. And I think it was an attempt to fill an emotional and a philosophical void that had been left by religion. I mean, from the time Reza Shah had come in and he had set himself up against the mullahs and he had taken away the veil and he had secularized Iranian society, I think Iran was a country in search of something to fill that void. And in a sense, art and culture, I think, were elected. That it was a failure, that it didn't meet the people's needs enough. I mean, it was part of a various series of things. If you were to talk to someone in the plan organization, if you were to talk to someone at television, each person would perhaps say, my thing, you know, was part of an attempt to give people a sense of unity, to create an Iran and nationalism. I think it was very much part of a sense of wanting to create a firm basis for the government and for the dynasty. The Pahlavis are a Pahlavi is a Persian name. It's the language that the Sasanians spoke. So it's a deliberate attempt. It was a period in time in which we were saying, we don't need Islam anymore. We don't need the mullahs anymore. We don't want them anymore. They belong to the Middle Ages. So anything that emphasized Iranian history, Iranian culture, was part of this. And I have to see arts and the patronage thereof, including the Shiraz Festival, which began with such wonderful intentions and ended in such a terrible fiasco. Not just that, there were all sorts of things. I do think there were folklore festivals. I remember there were attempts at the Mashhad area, you know, around Tus. There were folklore festivals, again, organized by Farrokh Dahbodi, who was one of the leading intellectuals and advisors of the Queen, who was responsible for the Shiraz Festival. So there were, you know, Shiraz was something that backfired. There were other festivals. There were other emphasis on local culture, local pride, tribal customs, this kind of thing, that you know, they were all part of a program that had a political sense, if you like, you know. Certain